32 degrees. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm excited that we can start today's program with Rachel Schwartz, Assistant Professor of Theater Arts at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, our friendly neighbors to the north. And I'm especially excited to be able to talk with her about an outstanding play called The Wolves by Sarah Delap. I happen to know a couple of the talented students who are in the cast for The Wolves, and they are excited about it, and I'm excited to have this conversation with Rachel Schwartz, who is directing this production. And these performances, and Professor Schwartz, I should have double-checked with you. I know there are performances this weekend. Does it run to the following weekend as well?
It does, next Friday, Saturday, and Sunday in a matinee time as well.
Very good. So we welcome you back to the morning show, and thanks for making time for this in what I'm sure is a busy week for you.
Well, thank you for welcoming me this morning. I'm always excited to join you.
So I have a feeling I already kind of know the answer, but I nevertheless want to give you an opportunity to kind of spell out why this particular play called The Wolves made so much sense, makes so much sense. To be done at a place like the University of Wisconsin-Parkside as part of your current season?
Absolutely. Well, there are a number of reasons that this particular piece was the best for all of our students' needs at this particular point in time, as well as being a great match for UW-Parkside. For starters, the play is about a high school women's soccer team. So it is a 10-woman cast, which is really exciting, and we were able to put that opposite our fall Shakespeare piece in order to add to opportunities for all of our performers. The piece really lends itself to opportunities for student designers, so giving that opportunity to those folks, as well as it just so happens that Parkside has an outstanding women's soccer team, so we were able to heavily partner with that soccer team in order to make this show possible. So truly, it was an exceptional fit as far as who we are as a university, as well as what our students need and providing opportunities for those students. It was exciting.
Right.
It was a great choice.
Yeah. I mean, it of course makes sense, first of all. And what I was primarily thinking of was just the fact that there are so many plays with more male roles than female roles. Anybody who's involved in theater is aware of that, and maybe that's beginning to change, but so many of the classics are heavily weighted towards male roles, so it's always helpful to a theater department when there can be a play like this that has so many great female roles. But then on top of it, I guess I hadn't even really thought about it till just now, is the fact that you don't have any 20-year-olds who have to play the grandmother.
There is one actress plays one of the players' mothers, but otherwise, absolutely, that's a great point. All of the other players on the team are roughly the age of our students. And so being able to cast students as people that are their age, telling stories that they have lived and experienced and understand, is absolutely a boon, for sure.
So let's give you a chance to kind of outline the basic format of this particular play, which centers around nine teenage girls who are all on a high school soccer team. Tell us how the play, in a sense, unfolds.
Sure. So we see 6 weeks of the students warming up for their indoor winter league games. So these players have mostly played with each other since they were wee little and on the on the Blossoms, which is indicated to be, you know, an early elementary soccer team. So they all know each other quite well. As it is soccer warm-ups, I partnered with, I was able to write a grant and hire a student as a soccer coach for the show. So there is a pretty significant amount of soccer being played during the show. So writing that grant and bringing on Janet Jurado as our soccer choreographer and coach was really a unique and fabulous opportunity. In that, this piece is like nothing I've personally ever worked on. As we're balancing, you know, traditional blocking and traditional, you know, directing, along with telling scenes while athletic drills are occurring, which is certainly nothing I've had to work through before, which was a really fabulous and interesting challenge. The nature of the dialogue heavily overlaps. So we had a number of really interesting things that made us have to rehearse this piece in a way that I've never rehearsed a piece before. So it was a really unique challenge. As young women do, these young women talk through the silly and mundane stuff, from their love of the Power Rangers and the Lord of the Rings, all the way to heavier topics that, while we wish young women wouldn't experience or understand, they certainly do. So, as a message to our viewers, there is some, you know, there are some heavier themes and there is some strong language in this piece. So that way they can opt in or opt out on their choosing. But it's really magnificent and it's really honest. Janet, our student coach, and I spent some quality time observing the UW Parkside student players, and the honesty of the dialogue of what we have in the piece and what we saw as they warmed up for their own games and for their own practices, it could not be better. And it's not a wonder that Sarah's piece was a Pulitzer finalist based on that honesty and integrity and excellence in writing.
Mm. And from what I understand, you know, this is a group of girls who are close-knit, as members of a team typically are to one extent or another. And yet this is also a group that experiences some conflict, which is also almost inevitable when you have people who are in a competitive situation and in close quarters, and adolescence on top of it, growing and maturing. and so, I mean, when one thinks about it, it's a brilliant idea because of the all of the opportunities that it affords the playwright to explore.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, to me, what was really fascinating is this is the, you know, she dramatized the stuff we pay no attention to, right? We are there to watch the game itself. So the life of the players off the field is something that we don't often consider. We don't listen to. We're not here for that. So to turn up the volume, as it were, on the moments of our lives that are often, you know, for those players, it's where they're truly expressing themselves, and something that we, as people who watch sports, you know, I'm a personally, I'm a big college football fan more than soccer, but nonetheless, you know, we know these athletes and we give so much of our time and attention to them, but how often do we know them at this level? So it's really, I think, in that way, fascinating.
When I read the syllabus, I'm sorry, not the syllabus, the synopsis of the play,
sure.
I think I'm correct in saying that in the synopsis, the girls were only identified by their player numbers. It referred
correct.
To what happens to 14 and 11 and 7 and so on. Through the course of the play, do we ever hear the names of these girls, or are they, for the most part, identified by their numbers as team members? And if so, what is the point of that?
Sure. So we exclusively get the names and backstories of these characters in the dialogue. We only ever know the names of two of the players, and we don't hear those names until my edition of the script is 163 pages long, and I think it's on either page 160 or 161.
Wow.
And that's the first time, and those names are said maybe a sentence apart. So we exclusively know these people as players. And for me, the exciting thing about that was it left a lot of space open for my cast in order to create characters that they knew and loved and understood. That was really exciting, as there is such limited background information about these characters. You know, typically you get, you know, name and relationships and all of these things, and there are hints of all of these things provided within the dialogue, but it takes a deep dive. But we've also had a really great time. I give my cast members the question of the day, and they respond, they come back the next day with to tell me their character, you know, does your character have pets? Are they a cat or a dog person? What's their favorite? What's the song that they're jamming out to right now? What is their favorite movie? All of those sort of things to cultivate that relationship, and that as these players are so close as team members, they need to know one another. And the playwright certainly didn't provide that for us, which is such a cool challenge to overcome in the direction of this piece, as well as the performance of it. So it's, you know, to keep that level of identity in their playing, right? And then that we are exclusively, you know, we stay in the air dome that they warm up in. We stay talking about them as players. It really grounds us in that, you know, in that physical moment in time, and reminds us, truly to me, how much at this juncture in their lives of their identity is wrapped up in soccer. I mean, they talk about their collegiate goals and what happens from here, and it's deeply wrapped up in their athletic identities, which for our theater students, you know, they feel the same way about the art that they create. So it was a really kind of unifying understanding.
We're speaking with Rachel Swartz, Assistant Professor of Theater Arts at UW Parkside, who is the director of Parkside's production of The Wolves by Sarah DeLapp. The performances begin this coming weekend. There are 9 teenage girls in all who are on this soccer team. And I thought I would ask you about a couple of them. One of the most intriguing characters in this play, I think it's number 46, is a new girl and someone who is homeschooled. So there's a couple aspects right there of this particular person that, in a sense, sets her apart from her teammates and makes for kind of an interesting relationship that really evolves through the course of the play. Tell us more about that.
Sure. In addition, we find out over the course of the play that 46's mom is a single mom, and she's a travel writer, and they've been all over the world, but that character has never had the traditional teen experience in school, in a community, and she talks in the play about how whether or not you speak the language, soccer is soccer all over the world, and it brings communities together. So that, I think, is really a big reason why Sarah put her in there. But, you know, unlike the eight other players who have played together since they were, you know, I would guessing from the piece, you know, in first or second grade, and have known each other all of their lives, to see them all navigate sharing this portion of their lives with a stranger and with somebody whose background is so separate from theirs. And it's, of course, the addition of someone new is always a great source of conflict in a play. So it it naturally serves that purpose. But I find that player to be so so wise and so wonderful, and yet also so so naive of the things that are taken for granted by the other players in terms of how to coexist with nine other teenage girls, rather than, you know, her existence in Kampala or any of the other really fantastical places she's lived with her mom.
Fascinating. We also experience, I'm not going to say the number of the young lady, but one of these players suffers frightening and, I believe, essentially career-ending injury at some point during this season. And I'm so glad that that is in the mix, because that is something that is, of course, such a sobering reality, really, for anybody playing any kind of competitive sport, is that very real possibility that's always kind of hanging there like a specter, that all of this could end if I go down and tear up my knee or tear up my hip or whatever it might be. And that's part of this story as well.
Absolutely. Yes, one of the players does suffer some major ACL damage during the course of the show. So the discussion of what that means in terms of surgery, and that she's missing then the college showcases where they're being scouted, and what that may mean in terms of her future is really, really quite remarkable. So that is certainly an area that, you know, when I went to observe the women's team, I sat down with two of the players that were out on injury, and, you know, were in the process of recovering, thankfully, and it wasn't a, you know, while those injuries were serious, they were not anything that will keep them from returning to the game. But, you know, absolutely understanding that that one's college future is at stake on the rare slide tackle or whatnot. It's really intense for these young athletes. It's a lot of pressure.
It sounds like Sarah Delap has done a really great job of creating something that rings so true. I mean, that feels completely authentic. And I don't think that's something that should be taken for granted, because I think there are plenty of instances of a playwright who comes along and tries to do something sort of like this, but doesn't, in a sense, understand who they are writing about, or does not really understand how these particular kind of characters would tend to interact in something resembling real life. And it just comes off kind of stagey and false. And although I've not seen The Wolves myself, from everything I've written about it, it sounds like Sarah Delap has done an exceptionally fine job of making us feel like we are peering into the real lives of real young women.
I couldn't agree with that statement more. And in as such, there are moments that it is brilliantly funny, and that these young players are celebrating and joking about the most absurd things. And there are moments that are deeply sad, and they're deeply stressful. By simply accepting that she intended to show, you know, 6 weeks in the lives of these students, she gets to show them at their best and their most joyful and their absolute worst and through some of the greatest hardships and losses of their lives. So it's by simply not choosing a direction and saying this is going to be a fantastical comedy about soccer, or this will be a deeply touching drama about soccer. She instead leaned into this is about young women who play soccer and their lives like anyone else's change, and we can't have a soul feeling about that. There's so much space and integrity in the way that she wrote this show, and I just find it to be so delightful, and our students find it to be so deeply relatable. It's been a marvelous experience to put together this piece.
Hmm. I want to finish by giving you a chance to explain a little bit more about the collaboration between you and the soccer team at Parkside.
Yes, absolutely. So Brittany Nikolic is the head coach of soccer at UW Parkside. And when this piece was chosen, I'll be honest, Greg, I was horrified. I had never kicked a soccer ball in all of my life, right? And I'm not, that is not my vibe. I was a dancer and a theater kid all the way growing up, was never a student athlete. So the rich knowledge of soccer and the amount of drill and choreography presented in the show was so outside of my purview. And the piece was initially chosen. We additionally have a first-year seminar class about combining theater and athletics and talking about a number of the great pieces that tell these stories. So that's another reason why the piece was selected. And as our only woman on our directing team at Parkside, it had to be me. So I went, oh God, right? Now I've got to direct this thing. What on earth do I do? And, you know, again, I was able to successfully write that grant and hire on a student to handle that choreography within the piece. But I also reached out to Brittany, and she responded almost immediately. And she opened up her practices for me to go see. Our guest has gone and watched the team's games and has supported them in that to see what it is to play. We've invited the soccer team to be our dress rehearsal guests. You know, she has been fantastic as far as a resource in answering questions and providing drill ideas. And I mean, my goodness, even loaning us soccer balls for the production, right? To be fully transparent, but answering so many research questions and being such an incredible resource. As well as providing space for myself, for my drill choreographer, for our cast members to access those players, as well as for those players to come and join us on Thursday night for our final dress. And I'm thrilled to give space to those players to, you know, see some of their own experiences on stage. You know, when I first started chatting with the players about it, they were like, there's a play about us. There's a play about people who play, like, it happens here. They were so excited and so intrigued that someone wanted to tell their story. So I think that partnership has really been incredible and fascinating. And I'm glad to have a new friend and colleague over in the athletic department. It's been really marvelous.
Fantastic. So tell our listeners exactly when and where these performances will take place and what people should do if they want tickets.
Absolutely. So as Greg said, the show is at UW Parkside. It is in our Black Box Theater. The show is in proscenium setup, meaning we have only about 100 seats, so it's deeply intimate. So if folks are interested in attending, I do recommend acquiring tickets in advance. They can do so by contacting the UW Parkside box office, or going to the RITA, R-I-T-A website. We have shows on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, both this week and next. Friday and Saturday performances are at 7 p.m. and Sunday at 2 o'clock p.m. And I couldn't welcome them more. It's truly a marvelous experience. And it's the show only runs 95 minutes, so a quick and exciting piece through the world of high school athletics.
The play again is The Wolves by Sarah Delap, and the director of the production, Rachel Swartz, assistant professor of theater arts at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. Thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. I hope I get to see The Wolves, and I know many of our listeners are going to want to see it as well. Best wishes to you and to your cast and crew for this production.
Thank you, Greg. I hope to see you there.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. My guest for this portion of WGTD's Morning Show is Dr. David Geyer, who is a highly regarded orthopedic surgeon and sports medicine specialist, who not only helps young athletes to recover from their injuries, but also helps the rest of us understand the nature of such injuries, the ways in which such serious injuries perhaps can be avoided, or the risk at least can be lessened, and helps us understand the reality of what an athlete, especially an elite athlete, is facing in trying to come back from what are often devastating injuries, and injuries that once upon a time would have meant the end of their career. But now, with the wonders of modern medicine, it is possible for many athletes to return to the field, to the court, and in some cases, even return to achieve every bit the excellence that they had achieved even before their injury. Dr. Geyer's new book is called That's Gotta Hurt, The Injuries That Changed Sports Forever, in which he examines a number of specific athletes and specific injuries which they suffered, which really helped sort of change the game in the sense of helping us understand the nature of certain injuries and what it means to come back from such from such devastating injuries. And it's a very, very interesting book published by 4EDGE. Dr. David Geyer, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you here. I'm curious if you came into the field of sports medicine as an athlete yourself, and if that's one reason why all of this is so interesting to you, or were you simply drawn to medicine and then for no particular reason drawn to the arena of sports medicine specifically?
Well, I was an athlete. I wouldn't call myself a terrific athlete. I didn't play, obviously, in the pros or even at the college level. I did play travel soccer and a variety of other sports, and still like to be active now, lift weights every day and do a variety of other things. So in a lot of ways, I still consider myself an athlete. I just don't get paid to do it.
Hmm. You begin your really interesting book with an event that occurred back in 1970. And as we first begin reading it, we have no idea the particular person you are talking about or the particular incident. And the longer we read it, the more it starts to become clear which moment in sports you are talking about. And it's not an elite athlete in the sense of anybody that that any of us have heard of, and yet it's somebody that just about all of us have seen. Explain to our listeners how your book begins and why you chose to begin it this way.
Yeah, I think that's great. It's a name, you're right, nobody knows, a guy named Vinko Bogataj, and I may be mispronouncing that. He was a Slovenian ski, I think they, now it's basically, they call it ski flying back then, but it's what we think of with the downhill skiing, the ramps, the ski jumping, and he was the legendary crash on the wide world of sports, and, you know, the agony of defeat guy. His crash follows those words. And I chose him because Wide World of Sports sort of paralleled the explosion in sports in terms of the prominence in society with 24/7 cable sports coverage and talk radio and the internet. But it also was a moment that had a tremendous impact on the sport. You don't think much of that one ski jumper basically having a crash, and you think it's interesting and you hate it for him, but we never really heard what happened to him. He really did not suffer that significant of an injury. He had a concussion, but he was fine. But it had a devastating impact on the sport of ski jumping. Basically, that footage being shown week after week convinced parents that the sport was really unsafe, and basically it really went away largely in the United States. There were other factors, but that's what I wanted to show in this book, how one injury could have a tremendous impact, both positive and negative, on the sports and on the athletes.
Right. In this case, perhaps dissuading certain people from pursuing a sport that looked very, very dangerous. If all you know about this sport is this infamous bit of film footage, and of course in other cases, your book explores ways in which a particularly devastating injury helped maybe change the way the rules were written for a sport, or the way in which equipment was designed to safeguard the well-being of the athletes, and in some cases we are talking about sports injuries that perhaps helped to prompt or helped bring into focus new ways of treating such a devastating injury. That's a part of the way in which we learn about one of the greatest female runners of all time, the great Joan Benoit, who won the first gold medal for women's marathon running at the Olympics. That was back in 1984. But not long before that, Joan Benoit had suffered a very, very serious knee injury. Explain what made her injury so serious and what made the treatment of it, in a sense, so groundbreaking.
Yeah, I mean, and it's a fascinating story. She was training, as you say, for the first ever women's marathon in the Olympics, training for the Olympic trials. She was the world record holder at the time and was easily going to win that, and started developing this pain in her knee that was not getting better. She was seeing doctors all over the country, getting all these treatments, getting shots in her knee, and nothing was working. And so she saw a doctor that was affiliated with Nike, who sponsored Benoit, and he said, "Hey, we've got one last thing to try. Let's scope your knee. Let's, you know, do an arthroscopic knee surgery," which was fairly novel at the time. It seems so commonplace now, but basically he was able to look in through small incisions with a camera, find the source of the pain and take care of it. And she was able to compete 17 days later after that surgery and win the marathon trials, which even today would be unheard of, to be able to compete at that level 17 days after arthroscopic knee surgery. But that raised so much attention. It really put arthroscopic surgery on the map. And, you know, now it's one of the most common surgeries in all of medicine.
Hmm. You also go on from there to tell the story of a legendary basketball player by the name of Bernard King and his return after a devastating ACL injury. And essentially what you say in this chapter is that not long before that, this kind of injury would have really spelled the end of such an athlete's career, or at the very best, they might have, you know, limped back and hobbled around playing maybe at a third of the level that they played before. And so Bernard King's comeback was quite extraordinary. Explain how such a comeback was possible.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. And before Bernard King's time, doctors, we would put patients in casts and let their knee become stable, but it would get really stiff. And you just can't play sports at a high level with a stiff knee. And so it ended their careers. Bernard King was determined to not have that happen. So he underwent a surgery that has become very common, but then a grueling rehab over a couple of years getting his motion back, getting his strength back. And he got back to play at an all-star level. He made the all-star game. He was the first elite athlete to be able to do that. And it really set the way now for, you know, basically all athletes expect to be able to get back to play at the same level. And it's not just pro athletes, even though we have good success rates at that level, but it's high school kids, college kids, even younger than that, and then adults that just like to play sports and exercise. Now 100 to 150,000 Americans get that surgery every year, and because of the changes, the advances we've made, we can expect that they're going to get back to do what they love to do.
We're speaking with Dr. David Guyer about his book, That's Gotta Hurt, The Injuries That Change Sports Forever. By the way, I wanted you to share with our listeners one really beautiful moment from this chapter about Bernard King. And it really underscores how grateful he was to the doctor that had helped make his comeback possible. Tell our listeners about Bernard King's ability to return and make the All-Star team and the gesture which he made upon that occasion.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really great. So Bernard King, everybody told him that there's no chance he's ever going to get back to play, but for good reason. Nobody really did before him. But, you know, he had a terrific surgeon, Dr. Norman Scott, who is the doctor of his team, the New York Knicks, and his physical therapist, Danya Schweitzer, who he would basically see 5 days a week at his house. She would drive from Manhattan into New Jersey to work with him every single day for well over a year. And the three of them, they worked so hard. And to be fair, he makes the comment, really, they were the only three that thought it was possible that he could play again in the NBA. So when he made the All-Star team, he brought Dr. Scott, he brought Danya Schweitzer and her husband to the All-Star game, gave him signed basketballs because he was so grateful that basically it was just the three of them that believed he could do it. And sure enough, he did.
Yeah, I like the way he says something to the effect that there were three people. It was the culmination of a dream that only three people thought possible. And of course, one of those three was Dr. Norman Scott, who was there to cheer him on. Your book goes on to explore the stories of a number of different athletes and various injuries, and for the most part, we're talking about, you know, sort of the stories of what we've just recounted with these first two. But in some cases, we're talking about injuries that sort of give us access to more overarching questions. And I wanted to take a little bit of time to talk about this. In Chapter 8, where you are really exploring the notion of medical evaluation and clearance of athletes to play. And in the chapter, I think, that comes right after that about Michael Jordan, where we're talking about the question of how an athlete can and should decide whether or not to return to play. I mean, at what point is it better for me to get out there and play again? Let's talk first about the whole matter of medical evaluation and clearance. I think your chapter here really underscores how tricky a matter this is and really crucially important too. Tell us the story of this particular athlete and how it sort of raises this really intriguing issue.
Yeah, so I start the chapter talking about Sam Bowie, who probably not a real household name unless you're a diehard NBA fan, but he was the player drafted right before Michael Jordan in the 1984 NBA draft, and it's widely regarded to be the worst draft pick of all time, one, because Jordan became the best player ever to play, but Sam Bowie also couldn't stay healthy. He had multiple injuries, and during college, he missed 2 years of college because of a stress fracture in his leg. And it explores the whole question of, is that something that the team and the doctors should have been able to predict? Could he have a problem that was not going to keep him from staying healthy? And Portland, the team that drafted Sam Bowie, has a history of drafting multiple players that just haven't been able to stay healthy, Bill Walton and Greg Oden and Brandon Roy. And so it explores the whole question of, you know, how do we tell? You know, if they've had an injury, how do we know they've fully recovered? Yes, we can get x-rays, and now we get MRIs, and we can, there's lots of things we can do, but we can't see pain, and we can't necessarily predict the future. There's a lot of analytics going on right now, a lot of studying of statistics to get to where we can predict these injuries and how well that's going to predict how, if a, you know, basically an athlete can play, can stay on the court, stay on the field. But at the end of the day, with millions and millions of dollars on the line, you know, these, if you're wrong, I mean, it's devastating for a franchise. And it's really, like you say, very tricky to figure out, despite our best tests and surgeries.
Yeah, and you really don't envy the doctor who is placed in that position. I mean, you certainly don't envy the athlete either, but you really don't envy the doctor who shoulders the responsibility of clearing an athlete to play. And yes, I like in your this chapter about Sambui, this sort of irony that there was actually Michael Jordan who suffered an injury quicker than Mr. Bowie did, and there were at least a few people who were saying, wow, it's a good thing we drafted Sambui instead of Michael Jordan. And then, of course, Michael Jordan eventually goes on to this long and extraordinary career, and Sambui just can't quite stay healthy. It really underscores for all that an athlete can do to remain healthy and be in the best shape that can possibly be, it's about more than that, and it's a capricious thing, and sometimes good luck and bad luck has at least some role to play in this.
Yeah, it really does, unfortunately. And that gets to sort of the bigger picture, too, and I write about this later on in the book about how does this apply to all of us, that we just love to play sports and exercise. And I think it stresses points like getting your injuries checked out by a doctor early and not trying to push through it to make sure it's not something serious. It talks about taking enough time to rehab to make sure you're 100%, and then it introduces the concepts of at what point do we, after so many injuries or so many aches and pains, do we say, hey, maybe I shouldn't do this anymore? You know, these guys, you know, I talk about Bill Walton in the Sambui chapter, had 37 surgeries. You know, at what point do we say, hey, you know, we got to stop and stop putting the wear and tear on our bodies? But yeah, you're right. If the guys that can stay healthy, the adults listening to this, that, you know, if they can stay healthy, you know, that's great for being able to play with your kids and being able to run in your 60s and 70s. And we're getting better in the sports medicine world at helping people do that. But you're right. A lot of it is dependent on luck and your body makeup.
Right. And of course, as we said, you explore this question of when should an athlete return to play in a chapter devoted to the great Michael Jordan, one of the great legends. The Bulls won 6 NBA championships. He was league MVP 5 times, NBA Finals MVP 6 times, a 14-time All-Star. And yet he found himself, although he certainly did not have an injury-ridden career, he couldn't have done what he did. On the other hand, Michael Jordan faced all kinds of injuries during that long career and over again had to sort of figure out the best way for him to listen to his own body.
And that was really a source of concern of his during, especially early in his career when he had the fracture in his foot that caused him to miss about half a season. He did listen to his body and said, look, I feel fine, I can play. But the doctors and the team held him out for many, many weeks after that. And it's interesting because that's sort of the opposite of what we hear now. These players at the pro level feel that doctors are trying to rush them back before they're healed because the team needs them to play and the fans, you know, they make money on the fans and ticket sales. And so there's these stories about how pro athletes don't trust their doctors. So it's an interesting sort of dilemma in terms of, you know, communication between the doctor and the athlete and the team and trying to figure out what's best, yes, you know, for short term, getting somebody back to play, but it doing it in a way that doesn't risk shortening an athlete's career and hurting their long-term health. And it's really a tricky problem, more than you would really think. And so I go into that in a lot of detail, because we, at the end of the day, have to keep these guys healthy, not just so they can play longer and make money longer, but so they can play with their kids and be active later in life.
It's also important for us to acknowledge that sometimes injury and other issues can not only lead to devastation later in life, such as what we've heard so much about with head injuries, perpetual head injuries that can really cause long-term brain damage, which you explore in a chapter about Dave Duerson, but also there are those rare instances in which we are even sometimes talking about an athlete's life tragically coming to an abrupt end. You talk about that in a chapter about a member of the Minnesota Vikings named Corey Stringer. And some of our listeners, at least, I'm sure, remember this tragic story of Corey Stringer dying after collapsing due to heat stroke. Say a word about this and how we can safeguard against such tragedies from recurring.
Yeah, it was devastating. It was basically, and you don't think of Minnesota being somewhere that's really hot, but it was in the, you know, 100, close to 100 degrees, really hot humidity in training camp, and the players are in, you know, pads and helmets, and he basically started overheating, had, you know, heat, went into heat stroke where he became confused, and by the time the ambulance got there and they got him to the hospital, his temperature was over 108 degrees, and they couldn't save him. What's important about it is that that's largely a preventable problem, both from hydration and getting gradually used to hot and humid conditions with adding longer practices and two-a-days and adding in equipment slowly, and that's really been implemented, especially at the high school and college level, but also recognizing heat stroke and starting immediate treatment on site, not waiting for the ambulance to take them to the hospital, but do the ice water baths and things on site. And we've gotten to where we can pretty much eliminate any player dying if the right steps are taken, but it still happens 5 to 10 times a year. So while it is preventable, which is a really good thing, we still have to get the awareness out there, the education out there to keep these athletes alive.
At the end of your book, I think one of the things you touch on in your conclusion is that these breakthroughs in medical science can help us keep our athletes safe and can make comebacks possible that a few years ago would have been absolutely inconceivable. Sort of the double edge of it is it makes fans of sports and athletes themselves also perhaps tempted to be impatient or to have outsized expectations about what is possible. We still have to be careful. We still have to listen to our own bodies.
You're absolutely right. I mean, these concepts still apply to all of us. You know, listen to our bodies, not trying to push through pain, get it checked out. But it's also leading to, are we going to follow the path of the pros who are willing to try treatments like stem cells and PRP that are sort of unproven right now and not paid for by insurance? What's the role of that for us, that we just like to lift weights or run? I think that it's an exciting times in terms of what we're going to be able to do to heal active people, but there's still a lot of questions we have to answer if we're going to keep people healthy into their 60s and 70s.
This is a very, very interesting book. 13 different athletes are profiled and their stories, including the Tommy John surgery that is so well known in baseball, and as we mentioned earlier, the long term effects of brain damage for football players and for other athletes, for that matter, the dangers of extreme sports and so on. So much is explored in such thoughtful fashion in this book called That's Gotta Hurt: The Injuries That Changed Sports Forever, published by 4EDGE, and the author, Dr. David Geyer. Dr. Geyer, thank you so much for making time in your busy schedule for this conversation. I enjoyed this. Best wishes.
I really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Tomorrow on the morning show, John Hambrock and Ann Morse Hambrock, and the comic strip The Brilliant Mind of Edison Lee, seen in the Kenosha News and in newspapers across the country. Recently, The Brilliant Mind of Edison Lee won newspaper comic strip's highest award, the Reuben. And we'll be talking with John and Ann Morse Hambrock about that. And on Friday, Nan Calvert's monthly visit to the program. Her special guest will be a representative of the Wisconsin State Herbarium, one of the largest herbariums in the country. And we'll be finding out about the more than 1 million botanical specimens which they have available for viewing and study.